Welcome to RightsRadio.com, brought to you by StarPublications.com. That's Star with two R's. I'm your host, Dr. Joyce Starr, author of books on wide-ranging topics, including Defend Your Condo and Homeowner Association Rights, and also publisher of the first Homeowner's Defense Kit. I also offer telephone consultations on condo and homeowner association problems, as well as natural healing for health and home. Our topic today, sun protection clothing for women, men, and children. How sun protection clothing reduces melanoma and skin cancer risks while preventing visible signs of aging. Our guest is award-winning author, sun protection expert, and Coolabar Executive Vice President, Mary Mills Barrow. Mary has authored 3 books and 2 for children on this topic, Sun Protection for Life, Pretty Prom, Your Skin is Pretty Too, What Are These Spots on My Skin? And other books are also available on the Coolabar.com website. Her book, Sun Protection for Life, is written for the general population, parents, teachers, outdoor workers, and baby boomers. And this interview is a featured segment in our Skin Protection series. Welcome, Mary. It's wonderful to have a skin care protection guru on our show.
Thank you for having me.
Mary, I want to begin with an overview of what's happening in this country in terms of advice given about skin cancer prevention and detection. Can you give us that intro overview, please?
I'd be delighted to. The way I'd like to put it in perspective is to give a little bit of history about tanning in this country. And once you understand the history of it, you can see how tanning, and which is leading to so many different skin cancers, is actually a fashion. And in a sense, we're putting ourselves at risk simply for fashion. In the 19th century, we didn't like to get tan. In fact, white people in this country made a point of not getting tan because they saw it as a visible display of manual labor, and to be seen as part of the upper class, they avoided it. Then what happened was in the 1920, Coco Chanel, and nobody wants to put the whole blame of this on Coco Chanel, but she went to the French Riviera, and she came home with this beautiful tan, and suddenly the middle class in this country thought, well, this is a sign of wealth, this is a sign of being, of having leisurely time, this is a sign of prosperity. So suddenly everyone was out trying to get a tan. And that's when the trend did get started. In the meantime, we got into the war and we had soldiers over in the South Pacific. So, and the soldiers were getting severely burned. And so there was a lot of research, unbeknownst to the general public, being done on how to protect their skin. So we did have some research already starting on trying to prevent burning. But we did not have the science at that point that made any kind of link to what was happening at a present day getting a burn and what would happen then in the long term. But
it's wonderful to have this background. You know, we never hear about the evolution of tanning and how it became so popular.
Well, it's very important to get the perspective about it because it backs up the whole premise of the fact that when you get tan when you're younger, skin cancers then show up later. Because what they saw with it, with people getting tan and happily getting tan, particularly from the 1950s onward, we had the surfing culture in the 60s, and then by the 70s it became a year-round desirable look. And then by the 80s, doctors began to see a huge rise in the number of skin cancers. Now, is this because they were able to diagnose them better or earlier? That can't be answered. But what they did see was that people started getting tan, and then 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, the numbers of skin cancers rose exponentially. And that's a very important thing to know. then often in the meantime, we started getting tanning beds. Tanning beds were developed in Germany, and then they became very popular in this country in the 1980s. We're now seeing a huge rise in the number of skin cancers that they're beginning to link directly to the use of tanning beds. And again, there is this time delay, but the cancers are there. The sad thing about the tanning beds, and I won't get off the subject too much on this, is the cancers show up far more quickly, and so therefore they are hitting a younger segment of the population.
Well, going back historically again for a moment, because you intrigue me with this, of course you have the Egyptians and the ancient Near East and, you know, major parts of the world that were exposed to sun constantly, and not everybody was covered up all of the time. Is it a relatively new phenomena to see this level of cancer? Did they have it at that time as well? Or don't we know?
I'm having a little bit of a hard time hearing you, but from what I heard, you were asking whether or not the levels of skin cancer are showing up in other parts of the world.
In a distant time, in a distant era.
In a distant era. Where they started showing up as early as I know about would be in the 1980s. They had a huge rise in the number of skin cancers in Australia. And this is about 20 years before we saw the same kind of development in this country. They did in Australia, even in the 1980s. Now, Australia has a much smaller population, so it becomes almost a micro case for people to look at. But in the 1980s, they started a national campaign over there called the Flip-Flop-Flop Campaign, immediately targeting children for prevention and the older adults for detection. But unfortunately, in this country, while we heard a little bit about that campaign in the 1980s, there were articles about it in the New Yorker, and there were one or two articles in the New York Times. Generally, we didn't pay any attention to it because we dismissed it as the country had worse ozone layers, and they were also closer to the equator. We now know that there are a lot of other factors involved in getting skin cancers, and they are showing up in this country for very similar reasons as they were in Australia. And those factors are things like your color of skin, what your skin type is, as well as things like where you are in the country and how close you are to the equator.
Now, you've developed something called SunAware. Can you tell us what that stands for and a little bit about it?
Generally, what happened for me is that my husband and I lived, my husband is Australian, and we lived over there for a number of years. And when we came back to this country, we were absolutely amazed that there was so little about skin cancer prevention and detection. In response to that, we did start up Coolabar.com, which is a company that manufactures primarily sun-protective clothing, although we also sell all kinds of sun-protective products. What we found was that our clients started asking us a lot of questions. They wanted advice, and there was not any one place where all of that advice had been put together. In the 1980s, the pharmaceutical companies did a fantastic job in getting the general population to recognize that sunscreen was very, very important. And by 2000, most people in this country did realize that sunscreen was an important tool to use for sun protection. But what's happened since then was what happened in the 90s is more and more advice is coming out from all kinds of different concerned organizations, and that advice started getting muddled. And so people didn't know, for example, how to use sunscreen. It's now, studies are showing that most people use sunscreen incorrectly, and by using it incorrectly, they may be increasing their chances of getting skin cancer, which is, you know, exactly the opposite of what sunscreen is meant to
Can you talk about that for a moment, what it means to use it correctly?
Sure. Sunscreen needs to be applied every hour and a half to 2 hours, and it also needs to be applied reasonably thickly. It takes at least an ounce to cover sufficiently. If you don't reapply sunscreen, it breaks down. What most people misunderstand about sunscreen is the SPF label that will say 30 and above does not mean that you can stay outside for 30 hours. It simply means that you can stay outside 30 times longer than if you did not put on sunscreen. But to do that, you need to reapply it every hour and a half to 2 hours because the ingredients in it break down as soon as they are exposed to the sun.
And what if it has zinc oxide, or you're just using zinc oxide instead of sunscreen? Would that also break down?
I actually think zinc oxide is probably the best ingredient to use. Zinc oxide is what is known as a blocker or a reflector, so it reflects, it's a physical block to both UVA and UVB. It reflects it away from your skin. Most of the other ingredients are what are known as absorbers, which means the sunscreen itself absorbs the UVA and UVB before it penetrates your skin. But I think that those absorbers tend to break down more quickly than the blockers. And I think that using zinc is the best way to go.
But as you said, even if you apply the zinc, do you have to reapply zinc also every hour and a half? And what if you apply it in the morning when you're in your home and then you go out a few hours later?
Zinc, I don't believe you have to reapply it as often because it is a physical block. You will see zinc break down, particularly the white zinc. You'll see when you need to reapply it. There is micronized zinc now, which you can find in a lot of different moisturizers, and you can use it underneath your makeup. And I think that's probably the best way to go.
But also very expensive.
It is very expensive, but now what you should remember about using these kind of sunscreens and sunblocks is if you use them in conjunction with sun-protective clothing, you're not using anywhere near as much as you would be if you're trying to put it over your whole body. Sun-protective clothing then covers you anything and everything other than your face and hands and maybe the tops of your feet.
Well, let's move into that, and please give us a brief history of sun protection clothing, because people don't understand how it evolved.
Okay. Sun protective clothing actually evolved in Australia. Again, it was part of the slip-slop slap campaign. It was slip on a shirt, slap on a hat, and slop on sunscreen. Now, when we were first being told in this country about sun protection, we were really told just to use sunscreen. And we did not use those other two tools, which is clothing and hats. In Australia, it's been part of their protection regime right from the beginning. What they have found in Australia in studies of the market is they actually do sell proportionally more sun-protective clothing than they do sunscreen. The reason for that is that there's a lot of reasons for it, but the biggest reason for it is that it's a very practical solution. You don't have to put it on every hour. You keep it on all day long. You don't have to buy it constantly, so you're not spending $12 to $50 per bottle, depending on what kind of brand you're getting. You're buying a shirt one time, and you're using it, you know, for one season or four seasons or five seasons, however well you take care of it. So it is a much more practical, much more economical way of protecting yourself against UVR.
And you have hats, and you have shirts and pants and swimwear. It comes in all forms.
Absolutely. And there has been studies all over the world about what size the hat brim should be. You should always have at least a 3-inch brim. Baseball caps do not do it. because baseball caps do not cover the tips of your ears and they don't cover your nose. The 3-inch brim all the way around is what's been studied and what will most effectively cover your head and the back of your neck. There are sun protective gloves that cover the tops of your hands. They're particularly important for people who drive and they keep their hands next to the window or on the window ledge. You find a lot of skin cancers on the left arm and the top of your left hand, and that's from the driving, that's from windows of cars. There's sun protective shirts and clothing for all different sports. Coolabar.com is fantastic for using fabrics that are specifically made for different activities when you're outside, so that you stay cool. I think it's unrealistic to think that any one fabric will work for all different activities. There are rash shirts or swim shirts that can go into chlorine or salt water and stay viable and sun protective, you know, for children all day long. They were actually developed in Australia. That was the first sun protective clothing that was developed came from the surfing culture. And rash shirts were worn by the surfers. Really, first they were worn to protect their stomachs from rashes from the surfboard. But it was soon noted that they were fantastic sun protection. And so the Australian government actually invented the, called a neck to knee, and you'll see children wearing them. They're like bathing suits that cover you up from your neck down to your knee.
And the parents don't mind putting their babies in these clothes.
No, absolutely not. And also, studies have also shown that the earlier you start children using these kind of sun protective methods, the less they fight you about it. And that's one of the biggest problems we have here is that the children, particularly teenagers, will fight you about using these kind of things. In Australia, you find that even the teenagers will wear hats, and they are careful about wearing sun protective shirts when they're out on the beaches. You never, ever go to the beach in Australia and see people bare-chested or without shirts on, male or female.
I'm a big fan of your umbrellas, and I've been using sun umbrellas for as long as I can remember, with people always asking me, is it raining, when there was no rain, and looking at me very strangely. But of all the sun umbrellas I've used, yours is really the best.
Well, thank you. And shade is an incredibly important part of sun protection. What Coolabar.com does is we try very hard to provide all the different tools. And as I say, primarily we're focused on sun protective clothing, but shade structures and umbrellas are a shade structure are very important to that. One of the things to keep in mind, though, about shade is that it's not fully protective because you get UVR bounces from surfaces, and even if you're sitting under an umbrella or you're under a tree or whatever method of shade you're using, the UVR can bounce up from things like sand or from a white cement wall. So you still need to use other methods as well.
Well, I was wondering about that. For example, you're walking from your car to a store or some other destination using the umbrella. Well, if you're using an umbrella, it seems that perhaps you don't need a hat at that moment. But the issue is, how are you to protect yourself from the rays bouncing off the ground, or do they bounce off the ground?
They do bounce off the ground. The best way to protect yourself now is to get into the habit in the morning while you're brushing your teeth of putting on sunscreen on your face and hands and just using sun protective clothing. Now, I know a lot of people's reaction to that is, well, I live in a hot climate and the last thing I want to do is put on long sleeves. But again, I just want to reiterate that sun protective clothing, if it is made well and if it's using the right types of materials, should not be hot. There are materials that have been formulated in different places around the world that are lightweight. They're made, they're actually made to wick away moisture from your skin to keep you cooler. They're some of them are feel lighter and they're thin linen. So you shouldn't be put off by thinking you're going to be hot if you're using good sun-protected clothing. The trick, though, to finding good sun-protected clothing is to look at the label. And unfortunately, in this country, there are no standards yet for sun-protected clothing. So it's up to the consumer to make sure you're getting good quality by checking to see if there is a label. And the label should read that the clothing's been tested. And I can tell you a little bit about the testing if you're interested.
Yes, I think we're interested in everything you have to say.
Oh, okay. The testing on most of the clothing should be made at the beginning of the clothing's life cycle, but then it should also be made a second time after 40 washings. And it's that second testing that's important. If the garment holds up to the same standards after 40 washings, then that is a truly good sun-protective material. Also, the label should say that it's been tested according to the American Association of Textile Chemists and Colorists, test method 183. And that will say that testing method is the one that says it has been tested after 40 wash cycles.
Well, how long does the piece of clothing last? All right, 40, how about 80, 150, or does it last forever as a sun blocker?
Well, I don't think you can count on any piece of clothing lasting forever because a lot of it will depend on how it's worn and how it's cared for. The materials that we use give very, very clear instructions on how to take care of them. And we test all of our material after 40 washing, and Coolabar.com is actually the only company that specifically tests our bolts and materials every several yards instead of just every bolt. If that's not getting too technical.
No, not at all.
Okay.
But when you test it, what do you actually do to test it? How does one test the material for sun blockability?
Okay. There are different machines that... Just trying to think how to explain this. There are different machines that shoot the types of light that you have the UVA and UVB through the material, and it tests how much of that light will come through and how much of it is reflected back, depending on the materials and what they're made from, because sun-protective materials can be made from all different types of things. For instance, some of them are made with dyes that thicken the threads in the materials. Others actually have titanium dioxide in the materials. They're microfibers. So the machine will actually test how much of that light can penetrate the material. This is actually fairly important because a lot of people think that if you hold your clothes up to a window or up to a light and you can see through it or not see through it, that's going to give you an indication of whether or not it's sun protective. And that's actually not really true. It's probably safe to say that your clothing is sun protective if it's winter clothing and it's thick wool and you can't see any light through it. But the fibers in summer material absorb and reflect light differently. So, for example, a t-shirt that has a small thread count, it may have 100 threads per square inch, is not going to be sun protective. In fact, most t-shirts only offer about a SPF of 5, which is really not sun protection at all. And that's because the weave is too thin. Then the good sun protective clothing, when you hold it up, I'm getting a little bit boggled with this. The weave will be tighter. They'll probably be 400 threads per square inch, and then it will also have a sun-protective ingredient as part of the thread.
Well, I think it's very important what you're conveying, because it's not what we normally hear or read about when we're on a website or reading a magazine about sun care. They'll tell you buy this or buy that product, but rarely will they go into the details of how you can truly protect yourself. So I think it's very helpful indeed.
Well, what I've tried to do and what I think is an important movement going on in the country, is put together the basic methods of sun protection in an acronym. The acronym that I've used is SunAware. The reason I've done this is that, it's going back to the beginning of our conversation, there are so many different organizations and there are so many different researchers and scientists that have very legitimate advice on how to both prevent and detect skin cancers. But because that advice is coming at us from all different angles, it's really hard to absorb it. So I've taken all the advice that I can come across, and this is advice from the World Health Organization, from the American Academy of Dermatology, from Skin Cancer Foundation, from the National Institute of Health, from all different and various people from around the country and around the world, and tried to filter it into five different steps that are easy to remember. And the acronym is AWARE, and we've got a website that helps people out. SunAware.org. Are we back on?
Yes, we're back on. Something happened. Did you move back from a phone or towards something?
Nope, don't know. Haven't moved.
All right, I haven't either, so we don't know what that was. That was the... the spirit trying to tell us how important this topic is.
Well, we've got the acronym AWARE, and the acronym has been endorsed by several leading organizations that are concerned with skin cancer prevention and detection. Those organizations include the Dermatology Nursing Association, Neutrogena has backed it, Coolabar.com has certainly backed this up and endorsed it. And I really do think that if we can get a unified message or a unified, the five easy steps out there, then it will, can more easily be taught to children, families can remember it, it will work better. I can very quickly tell you what those points are.
Please.
Okay. The acronym is SunAware. It's based on the AWARE part. A is avoid. Avoid unprotected UV exposure anytime and seek shade. This is an important point, and it's important for several reasons, primarily that it has changed in the last 3 or 4 years. It is no longer, the advice is no longer to only avoid between the hours of 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. or 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. is to avoid all unprotected exposure at any time and seek shade. So that's worldwide. That's the nuance that's changed, and that's quite important. W is wear sun-protective clothing, including hats and sunglasses. The interesting thing about this is that this comes now before apply sunscreen, and this is from the recommendations given by the American Academy of Dermatology, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and several other major doctors' academies or science. Sun protective clothing is now considered the leading line of defense against skin cancer.
Here in Florida, and I see absolutely no one except myself walking around with umbrellas and hats and gloves, and I even put on arm guards, and I found them on your site, and that's what drew me to your site in the first place. I'd never seen them before, but they do help protect you when you're driving and just walking in the sun, and then you don't have the problem being too hot because you can take them right off. But I'm the only one, I can promise
you.
Well,
I think this is partly because we don't have a coordinated national campaign. We have a lot of different organizations trying very hard to get the message out there. There is the National Council for Skin Cancer Prevention that meets in Washington. That is a unified group of 45 different organizations. And within that, all of them are trying to get this message out there. But to date, there is not one message. The EPA has a different message. The American Academy of Dermatology has a different message. And while their advice is all the same, it's coming to the public in different words, so the public is not absorbing it very well. And that's why I really strongly feel that we need to have one unified campaign, very much like the Smokey the Bear, only you can prevent forest fires. If we just have SunAware, you can be SunAware, be aware of the dangers of ultraviolet radiation, be aware, then be aware of what the five steps of prevention are, then it's easier for the public, and then that's when we'll get people actually paying attention to these five steps.
Now, when we talk about that, I want to just mention here that we're going to do a special teleseminar on sun precaution soon, in 2009, in early 2009, and I hope people will go to rightsradio.com, right on the homepage, and sign up for our list for notification, and Mary will be a featured speaker on that teleseminar. We'll have other guests as well, and it promises to be quite important to the future of your skin and your life. And apropos, Mary, let's talk about the family, because if people don't care about themselves, they should care about their loved ones and their children. So let's talk about...
Absolutely, and historically, in Australia, the statistics show, in Australia, they did the Slip, Slop, Slap campaign, as I mentioned, and they did target children, and they targeted the aging group, and the aging group already had sun problems, and so that was for detection, but for children, it was prevention. And the elements of prevention for children are numerous, but what the biggest point I will make about this is you can't start too young. You can teach your children at the age of 3 or 4 to start doing skin checks. There are books out there that already out there that show children how to do skin checks and what to look for and what all the different spots on their skin mean and how to map them and how to keep track of how they change as they get older. You can teach them, as soon as you teach them how to brush their teeth, to start using sunscreens in the morning and put sunscreens on their face. In Australia, there are rules in the school, no hat, no play, which simply means if you don't bring your sun hat to school, you're not going out for recess. They have huge gallon pumps of sunscreen by the doors of the classroom so that children can put it on. In this country, unfortunately, there are so many rules about that sort of thing. In a lot of schools, a nurse has to be present before a child can put on sunscreen, which is, I don't want to use the word ludicrous because I understand that there are children that are allergic to sunscreen, but they're few and far between, and generally they know this. The parents know this and notify the school. What's more important is that the children know to use sunscreen, to use sun protective clothing, and they know it right from the time they're little. You can, like with seatbelts in cars, a parent uses the seatbelt. If you use a hat in the morning and if you put on sunscreen, your children are likely to copy you and do the same thing. So all of these different methods and all these just different ways of protecting children are very easy, and they're not hard to find out about because they're listed in places like the sunaware.org website you can go to, and also in the book that I put together, which is Sun Protected for Life. What I've tried to do is, what I have done is filtered all this advice from all the different organizations, and I do have a chapter in there that's specifically for children, and it discusses things like, you know, making sure that you have a blanket for sun protection when you bring your baby home from the hospital, or what to pack in your baby bag for sun protection to start that young to be thinking about this.
What about preteen and teenage boys who hardly want to hear about that in the United States?
Oddly enough, the preteens that I've focused on more are the girls, because the girls are using tanning beds, and the boys don't seem to be using the tanning beds the same way. The boys should and could get a lot of this information from their coaches and from the school. And if their coaches require that they use sun protective clothing and uniforms, they'll start getting it. They'll start understanding the importance of it. And that filters then through the school population. But the girls are using tanning beds, which is a different problem, and a much scarier problem in some ways, because they are finding that young girls between the ages of 19 and 27, skin cancers are being detected and diagnosed in that age group far more prevalently than ever before. And my guess, and I don't have a study in front of me, but my guess is that that is directly linked to the use of tanning beds. Fortunately, the dangers of tanning beds are getting to be recognized. Just a week ago or 2 weeks ago, the FDA has decided to change their signage or the labeling on tanning beds to more carefully let the consumer know what kind of risk they're taking by using them. In this country, there are only a few states that ban tanning beds for teenagers. And if you look around the world, it's such a significant problem that France completely bans them for teenagers. In England, they bring charges against parents. They will bring child abuse charges against parents who allow their children to use tanning beds. That's how serious it is. The use of tanning beds is for prom night and for other teenage activities has skyrocketed in the last 10 years. And what we'll find is that skin cancers, particularly melanoma, will also skyrocket.
I find it amazing that France and England are so far ahead of us in understanding the ramifications of something like tanning beds.
Well, I don't think they're far ahead of us in understanding it. I think that in this country, in America, and this is what makes it so difficult, the tobacco industry was a huge industry owned by a few companies. The tanning bed industry, or the tanning beds, are actually owned generally by individuals. So they're little mom-and-pop stores. If you start going after your small stores, it's a very different and much more complex and something that most legislators want to stay away from than if you're going after a large industry. So I don't know what the answer is going to be. I think that one thing that we could do is put a user's fee on tanning bed use and use that user's fee for education. My husband did a back of an envelope calculation, and if we put a 2% user's fee on tanning beds, we'd have enough money to do a huge national campaign on skin cancer prevention and detection, at which point we could educate the public about not using tanning beds. Now, and I do think, and I was thinking about this today, one of the silver linings, unfortunately, of this economy is that I do think that tanning bed use will drop down somewhat, because it's certainly not a necessary expenditure.
Let's talk for a moment about sports and the military, because it seems that there's almost a culture of the more you suffer in the sun, if you're a football player in training, if you're in the military or the Marines, you're in training, or any other aspect or arena of the military, that you're tough.
Right, and that's the Marlboro Man.
Yeah, you're tough.
I do. I hope that that's changing. And I do know that the military has always been very concerned about sun exposure and has actually devoted quite a lot of time and research to helping to prevent skin cancers, because they do understand. I mean, starting again back with our soldiers that were in the South Pacific, they do understand how detrimental this kind of sun exposure is. In terms of the macho image, I think that goes across our everything, all the different segments in our culture for boys. They, you know, you're right. It's, you know, the tanner you are, the tougher you look. Hopefully with education that will change. And I do think that education needs to really get started in the schools. And again, if we had a unified campaign, it would hit the football players, and it would hit the soccer players and the tennis coaches and the tennis. That tennis actually seems to be one of the sports that is focusing on this pretty well.
And how are they focusing on it? Well, still see the players fully exposed.
You do, but you also see some of them with the Legionnaires hats, you know, when the ones with the flags on the back,
right.
So it's encouraging.
But they're still wearing little shirts and little shorts, and their legs are all exposed.
I know, it's not good. It's very frustrating that it's taking so long in this country for this to catch on. In Australia, it really has caught on, and as I just made note in the tanning that industry anyway, in other countries, that's really...
Now, when it comes to melanoma, you've told me, and I've heard as well, that one person is lost every hour to melanoma.
That's right.
Can you talk a little bit about that and how it affects the elderly in particular, and might perhaps how it relates to our health care problems?
Well,
and moreover, just a PS there, it's not cheap to get it checked.
No, it's not. And that's why if we can, the earlier it's detected, the better. And if we teach our children right from the beginning on, you know, keeping a journal, keeping a map of their freckles and their spots and how they're changing, because the earlier they're detected, the better. Melanoma does, unfortunately, kill about one person every hour. The statistics are, of course, rising on it. I think, and of course, melanoma, the care for people with melanoma is naturally the highest cost, both financially and emotionally and every other way. I think the interesting thing that is often overlooked is the extraordinary cost in this country of treating the non-malignant skin cancers, the basal cells and the squamous cells, because while they are not life-threatening, the numbers are phenomenal. I mean, there are millions and millions diagnosed every year. In fact, so many are diagnosed that they can't actually keep records of what are called neoechinic keratosis, which is which is considered the skin cancer and which generally leads to the squamous cell skin cancers.
What's the result of that? What's the consequence?
Generally, what the consequence of it is disfigurement. These cancers tend to spread on the surface of your skin, and they can spread quite a lot. So to get rid of them, you often have a lot of bad scarring.
They leave scars.
Right.
But what if you don't get rid of them?
Eventually, and it's, you know, a very much of an eventually, they can become life-threatening. So you do have to get rid of them. These are not things you can just let go.
Well, I find it's just really chilling because, for example, an elderly person who barely ever sees a doctor may not have enough money to deal with their heart problems, let alone their skin condition. They wouldn't know where to start. They might find a skin doctor to see, and then they would say, well, you have this problem and this problem. But dealing with it when they can hardly pay their monthly bills.
It is a difficult problem. It's one of the problems in the medical system that's got to be addressed because it is a growing problem. I would suggest, though, for the elderly, if they can talk to their general practitioner, more and more of the general practitioners are being trained and are far more aware now of the different skin cancers. They will obviously refer them to a dermatologist if there's a problem, and if they can go to a dermatologist first, that's great. But as you say, you know, at a certain point, it's very difficult for people to go through all of these different hoops.
Exactly. And not only the dermatologist, because I'm talking about post-dermatologist actually getting the problem removed. That's very expensive. I remember taking my own father, having to find a doctor, because I could see that once he had arrived in Florida, his really perfect skin became very spotted, and took him in, and he had lots of things that had to be removed. And it was, I mean, it was thousands of dollars.
Right.
So people don't have that type of money, especially not today. It was difficult at that time, no doubt, but now you tell a person who's in their 70s or 75, 80s, sorry, it's going to cost you a few thousand dollars to get rid of these spots, and they say, I'm sorry, I'll live with it, or I won't.
Right. Well, unfortunately, I don't have a solution to this. This is part of what I hope the new administration is going to be able to address, and that's the health care. I mean, this is a huge part of the cost of the health care system, and it's a huge problem that more and more baby boomers are going to be addressing, and the medical profession is going to be addressing as well. And it is extremely costly. I wouldn't say it's a hidden cost, but it's a cost that's certainly not been discussed amongst the general population, and it is. It's an enormous cost to the
country. What about John McCain's problem? Do you think that brought more attention to it? I mean, in a sense, you didn't hear much.
I wish that John McCain had talked more about it. I wish that there had been a discussion about how, in the long term, prevention will lower these costs. In the near term, however, detection is what will lower the cost. And early detection is the way to go. Early detection saves lives, and early detection saves money. And that's, those are the, you know.
It's my view that the pharmacies, for example, that will test your cholesterol for free or a very low cost, or even the department store should have a little booth.
Right.
Where you can walk in and be tested.
Right.
Or they should have mobile units in front of...
There are a lot of dermatologists, fortunately, that will spend time going out and getting skin checks, primarily during the month of May, which is Melanoma
mm-hmm.
Awareness Month. And there are really, truly a lot of very concerned dermatology nurses, dermatology doctors that are trying to do just that, give free checks. But there are, unfortunately, millions of us that need these checks, and dermatologists are really being pushed to their limits in terms of how many people they can see and how much they can do.
But if it was done throughout the year, if there were little mobile clinics or little, you know, like we have an eye clinic, we'll have a little dermatology clinic,
right,
where you could walk in during the year and there'd be somebody there. It could even be a student in training, a medical student in training. Would that help?
Absolutely. I mean, it's as long as they are trained well to know what to look for. And the layperson and individuals need to know that this is their responsibility as well. Spouses need to check each other. Parents need to check children. And you need to be able to look at your own skin and know what you're looking at. And the American Academy of Dermatology and lots of other organizations do have very, very clear definitions or parameters of things for you to look at. They have the ABCDs of melanoma. They have different photographs to look at so you can compare things. I mean, it's actually a very easy process, and it's worth taking the time to learn how to do it and
what
do
website?
It monthly.
What website would that be?
The American Academy of Dermatology.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so that's AAD.com. Then also there's the Skin Cancer Foundation, has also a very strong website. the Melanoma International Foundation, which is run by a woman named Catherine Poole. She and DuPont Gary at the University of Pennsylvania have a fantastic book called Melanoma, which has two or three chapters in it on how to do skin checks, which is very, very good. For children, they're one of the books that we've got on our website. It's called What Are These Spots on My Skin by Scott Norton. And that's for young children, but it's amazing how our children educate us. And that shows how to do checks and what to look for and how to map your skin. So there is, the information is out there. It's not hard. It's very, very easy to do skin checks, and everyone should learn how to do it. And the other point I want to make, just as we're talking about this, is skin cancer is not a problem just for white people. Yes, it affects Caucasians far more than people of color, but skin cancers are showing up increasingly in people of color. So this is not just a white person's problem, and hopefully we will get the education out in schools that are primarily schools of color, and get this into the dermatology offices and the pediatrician's office, and so that the whole population learns about it.
What are some of the signs, and what's the evolution of it in people of color? Has it become, you know, much worse in the last decade, or it's been consistent?
No, it has become an increasing problem. I don't have the statistics in front of me, unfortunately, but I do know that it's become an increasing problem, and one of the reasons for it is because it has not been part of the education. People of color have not been included in the education, so therefore, when a person has been going to the doctor, they're usually much further along in the progression of the disease, so early detection has not been part of it because they're not thinking to look for it.
How can they better protect themselves? The same as everyone else?
Same as everyone else.
More that they can do?
Yeah, same as everyone else.
And I would imagine that the children are even less protected, therefore, as well.
Right.
Do you see an uptick in the type of education that's being given today to, as you say, people of color?
What I have noticed is that the problem is being discussed more in places like the National Council for Skin Cancer Prevention. Is it out among the general population? Is this a problem that's being discussed more in the general population? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think that people of color are getting this message.
And one thing you mentioned when we talked, and this really is for all people, and that is the economic burden. I mean, we've touched upon it now, but people put it off because of the economic burden. And my view is that society must help with that economic burden. On the one hand, the society doesn't educate sufficiently, not from the top down, and on the other hand, they don't help you.
Right. I don't have an answer for that. I'm appalled by the lack of medical concern in this country, in the sense that we don't have in place a system that works. But I think that if we can get into place a system that works, that addressing skin cancer will be a huge part of it. And I do think that there are numerous organizations that are trying their best to address it. And I think that if we can manage to put together a national campaign that goes from top down and bottom up, if it comes from the national organizations and comes from the schools and comes from the parents, then this will be helpful both in terms of life expectancy and lifestyle questions and the economics of it.
Well, Mary, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time, and I have to sign off now, but I want to remind our listeners that they can go to rightsradio.com and sign up for our new teleseminar series, and they can visit coolabar.com and find the most wonderful sun precaution and protection clothing and other accessories. And it's been a pleasure having you with us. Thank you again, Mary.
Well, thank you, and I hope this has been helpful. Thank you.
Very helpful. And this is Dr. Joyce Starr with RightRadio.com.
Thank you.